This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
G'day, thanks for downloading the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Today we meet ambidextrous artist David Lovegrove, who recently featured on a primetime Qantas commercial. We'll find out how he developed his unique two-handed drawing style and how his kung fu skills came in handy in the filming of the commercial. It's Children's Book Week. We meet charming children's author Cho Cho Brereton and find out how she made the transition from science to wordsmith. Feel like walking for 30 days? A new Sydney Harbour and Coast Walk runs from Barrenjoey down to the Royal National Park via Parramatta. Matt McClelland from Wild Walks has been out in all kinds of weather, taking on the 30-day challenge. It's final season, and that means a lot of parents losing their voices on the sidelines. Dr. Justin Colson is advocating an American concept known as silent sidelines, where kids play the game without the vocal input of their parents. Unbelievable. Have you ever put up with the flatmate from hell? You know, that person who never empties the bin or goes out and forgets to lock the house? Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City laments how hard it is to find a good flatmate. If you like the English movie, The Full Monty, you might be interested in the next film from Roberto Pasolini, Still Life. Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity found the film uplifting, even if the subject matter is a little morbid. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm joined in the studio by artist David Lovegrove. You might have seen his unique ambidextrous drawing style featured on the Qantas ads that ran during The Voice, but he's been around for a lot longer than that. And today we're here to learn how that unique drawing style came about. Welcome, David. Now, Hi. You're normally based on the North Coast, so what's brought you to Sydney?
Well, I'm doing another ad for Qantas. They sponsored Tropfest and what's called Tropvine. So I'm making a little six-second Trop Vine, double-handed vine.
Fun.
To help launch that.
And so how did this unique ambidextrous drawing style come about for you? How did you develop that?
After drawing for many, many years with my right hand, I was just bored one night, picked up the left-hand pencil and started doodling with it, and then both hands, for some reason, decided to start working together. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I just like new things. And, I've just played with it and found that it's not as hard as it looks.
So how long have you been doing this for?
I've been playing with it for several years, just getting really serious about it in the last year, I'd say, starting to apply it to fine art. And
because you've got a fine art background, don't you?
Yeah, so you've trained. I studied here in Sydney at Julian Ashton Art School, and I also did a master's in Griffith Uni in Queensland. So I'm very much an artist's artist, but I've worked a lot in, you know, illustration and advertising. I do a lot of lecturing.
And manga art.
Yes.
So how did you develop a love for manga?
My best friend at school was his parents were Japanese, and always had a love for Japanese culture. And I was in Bondi Junction one day and I found a box of comics in Japanese, and it was $5 for a whole box of them, and so I just walked off and discovered they're called manga and took it from there. That's probably 20 years ago, but I...
So you were ahead of your time, really, David.
Yeah, I was probably one of the first people in Australia really getting into it, I guess. But it sort of followed along with my passion for Japanese film, especially like traditional Japan and samurai movies and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. And I know you do a lot of workshop in school. So how do kids respond to your work?
Incredibly. Like, they love my manga workshops. They're very popular. And kids always line up, want me to sign things, shake my hand, say thanks a lot. They just love manga. But the double-handed thing, the first few times I did it, I remember I was in an auditorium with about 300 kids and teachers. And I just drew on the blackboard, and then everyone started cheering, clapping, standing up. I got like a standing ovation. I was really taken aback. And they seemed to think it was mind-blowing. So, and I tend to get that when I first do it for people. It seems to surprise them.
I think the interesting thing about that is that most often art is made behind closed doors. We see the finished work, but we don't usually see it being made. What you're doing with this is creating really a performance, and it's something that we can all be part of. Is that, do you think, why people love it so much?
Absolutely. I think the process of drawing, the process of creating a painting is a hidden thing, and every now and then you see a great artist doing something. Like, I remember Brett Whiteley showing how he created a painting, which was very influential on me back in the early 90s, and I wanted to be that sort of artist. But I've always considered people miss out on the power of drawing. And I had a class once of people who I did a drawing for a minute, and when I turned to look at them, they were all standing there as if they were sort of frozen. And one person had tears in their eyes, and they just went, "How did you do that?" You know, and it was it taught me that I should be showing people the magic of it. You know, it's the performance of it is powerful.
Yeah, it's very mesmerizing, and I know as a children's author that when I go to an event, if there's somebody there who draws in front of the kids, they will be spellbound. It will be the highlight. It's the bit that they really remember.
Yeah, and I think the kids especially pick up on the confidence. And I always say, look, you know, one of my teachers, Ian Chapman, used to always say, it's better a bold failure than a timid success. And another great artist who taught me in the early 90s, David Paulson in Brisbane, used to say, you know, work like a tradesman, you know, put your marks down, be bold, just go bam. And there's a lot to be said for that. You know, you're not timid, you just go for it and the energy comes out.
And how did Qantas discover you?
Well, I'd put a few videos on YouTube, on my YouTube channel, David Lovegrove Art, and just bizarrely, somebody emailed me and said, we're looking for somebody who can draw with two hands at once and you appear to be able to do it. Would you like to come and make an ad with Qantas? And of course I said, yeah, fantastic. And just surprised that somebody would be looking for a two-handed artist, you know. But
they were, and they found you. What was the process of filming like?
Well, we filmed in a huge old warehouse, and it was all, you know, I love technology, I love film, anything interesting. And there was all the lighting experts and the film expert and the director and his assistants and the people from Qantas putting their input in. And it's quite strange, you know, the big lights all around me. At one stage I was sort of squatting down in like what they call in Kung Fu a horse stance and drawing to the left because the camera needed to be over my shoulder. And I'm a Kung Fu practitioner. I've been practicing Wing Chun Kung Fu for many years. And if I hadn't been a Kung Fu guy, I wouldn't have been able to do it. But I'm sort of there in this difficult horse pose and drawing away.
Classic. Okay. So could you draw anything two-handed, do you think?
Yes. If I slow down and be careful, I could draw anything. My holy grail, I suppose, at the moment I mostly draw a mirror style, but what I really would like to do is be able to draw different things with each hand. And I've realized that if I think sculpturally, if I feel around the thing that's in my mind, I've sort of got a thing in like a box in my mind where I can see things and I feel around them, then it comes out right. And I'm also working on 10 finger drawing where I put 10 markers on one on each finger and then draw like that. And that's I've got one YouTube video of me doing that, but I'm going to do a lot more of that.
That's very interesting. Well, it's somewhat ironic for someone who has been plugging away at their art to find this fame and success through a commercial. It's not the path you would expect, but congratulations, it's going so well for you.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Katrina.
Yeah, I've been speaking with illustrator, manga artist and ambidextrous artist David Lovegrove about his unique style of work. Thanks, David. Well, I'm sure we've all heard of the Milford Track or the Cradle Mountain Track. Well, some forward-thinking enthusiasts have just set up the Sydney Harbour and Coast Walk. A handful of Sydneysiders are walking from Barrenjoey Lighthouse to Otford via Parramatta over the next 4 weeks to celebrate the opening of this new tourist attraction. Now, one of those who's taken on the 30-day hike is Matt McClelland from Wild Walks. G'day, Matt.
G'day, Katrina.
Now, this morning when I told Aaron and Dan that there was a new 30-day walk from one end of Sydney to the other, Dan said, why on earth would anyone want to do that?
So, that's the train.
What's your response to that, Matt?
Look, it's fantastic. We've only done the first 3 days so far, but it's been amazing, and especially with the weather as it's been. You know, we've had these storms and the rain, and it really gives you a different view of Sydney's personality. We're walking through It's an incredibly pristine bushland that hugs the coastline, and it is a stunning coastline. We're being tourists in our own city. This is a city that thousands of people fly into every day because it is so stunning.
Matt, I have to stop you. I'm sorry, but you sound like a ridiculous optimist. We've just had this most wild, crazy weather. You've been out walking in it, and you're talking about that like it's a good thing.
It was amazing. It was such a great. It was great fun.
Just for ordinary people who don't want to be out there in a gale or a cyclone, what do you get to see on this walk, Matt? And why would you do it?
Look, it's all about the scenery. This is the coast that people fly into from overseas. You know, it's the Opera House, it's the stunning Sydney coastline, and people do fly to Australia for it, and we get used to it because we live in the city. Mm. And when you take some time out to be a tourist in your own town, you really do get to appreciate how stunning we do have it. And so we're 3 days in. We've still got another sort of 25 days to go. And I'm really looking forward to it because it's going to be just get better and better and better. And it's not all natural scenery. There's some great history, both, you know, Aboriginal history going back 40,000 years, as well as European history. And we're meeting some great local people as we go. It's a lot of fun.
Okay. Now, saying that you've got 25 days to go makes it sound kind of tough. Could anyone actually do this walk?
Look, I'm 40, but the other guys who are on it are in their mid-70s. And so this is a walk really designed for anybody at any level of fitness. And if you just want to do sort of 5 to 10 Ks a day, you can do that. We're doing about 15 Ks a day, which means you're spending about half the day walking. And we're stopping at cafes for lunch. We're staying in hotels and B&Bs and caravan parks along the way. So it really is something for everyone. Now, I don't think most people will do it as a 30-day solid walk. Most people probably jump in and either do it as day trips or maybe as weekend adventures and stay overnight, catch the ferry or the train out and then come back next month and do another weekend and just sort of tick off the walk as you go, doing it like that over a year or something.
Well, that sounds good. Well, thanks for sharing the experience with us. How can regular people find out more if they want to do a little bit of it?
Great. Well, if you go to wildwalks.com and click on the link to Sydney Harbour and Coast Walk, .com. There's a link on the website there, and that'll take you through, and there's a map, and we're putting up more and more details as we get through this walk, and you can follow us as we go. And if people want to come down and wave to us and or even get started on the track, then more and more can do that, or send us an email and we can get you more information.
All right. We might wait until the rain clears up a little bit, though. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Katrina.
That's Matt McClelland from wildwalks.com and from the National Parks Association of New South Wales. He is one of around 10 walkers doing the new Sydney Harbour and Coast Walk for the very first time. Still to come on the Hope Mornings weekly podcast, Dr. Justin Colson explains the concept of silent sidelines, a review of the English film Still Life by the makers of The Full Monty, and we discuss the perils of finding a good flatmate. Well, it's final seasons, and that means a lot of mums and dads getting very worked up at their kids' sporting games, whether it's yelling instructions to your child about what they should be doing or taking it out on the ref when a decision goes against the team. Many of us leave the sporting field having exercised nothing more than our vocal cords. Dr. Justin Colson is on the line to talk about finals fever. How are you going, Justin?
I'm great, Katrina.
Now, fess up, do you leave every sporting game with a sore throat?
No. I'm one of those dads who quietly cheers when things go well and just chats with the other parents.
Okay.
I'm a fairly non-competitive kind of guy.
I can imagine that about you. Well, tell us about the idea of silent sidelines. Where does this come from?
Well, this is an American idea. It's been around for probably a decade or so. And the idea has come forward basically because there are a handful of parents, and they are only a small handful, that take things a little bit too seriously when it comes to junior sport. In fact, it happened in Australia too. A couple of weeks ago in Gippsland, there was a father who ended up on the sporting field in an under-12s game, absolutely losing it at a young boy who had tackled his son, and the referee hadn't said anything. The dad didn't like it, so he ended up on the field having a go at this little kid. It's going too far, and Silent Sidelines is an initiative where mums and dads are not allowed to say a word while they're on the sidelines in the direction of the children or the coach or the ref.
They're still allowed to cheer, aren't they, and clap and stuff when things go well, yeah?
They can clap politely, but they're not supposed to be cheering or whistling or screaming or making any noise. It's just simple applause, that's it.
And what's the goal of it, Justin?
The idea is a reminder that it's kids' sport. It's supposed to be fun. we don't need to take it so seriously, and we definitely don't need to be shouting advice or abuse at the referee or anybody else who's on the field.
Yeah. When I was reading up about this, I loved the example of, you know, the parent cooking in the kitchen, for example, and the child coming in and saying, "Oh, careful, careful, put in more butter. Oh, that's going to burn. Quick, if you don't flip that now." It's, you know, like no one likes to cook with someone telling them everything that they should be doing. And I guess maybe it's the same for sport.
We just micromanage everything that's going on if we care a lot about it. And there's a lot of parents who really, really do care. They have hopes, along with their children often, that those kids are going to become superstars and that every performance matters. The reality is it doesn't, especially at the junior levels. We got them involved because we want them to be healthy and fit and social and to have fun. And we forget that once the competition enters the picture.
Yeah, that's true. What about the issue, though, of the atmosphere? There might be parents listening to this who would be thinking, oh, but, you know, all that noise and everything, it all creates part of the atmosphere. I mean, what's the downside of the noise?
I think that there's a couple of issues. First of all, when you've got somebody constantly screaming in your ear, it's really hard to think and it's really hard to do what you want to do. But additionally, it's really disempowering. I mean, if you're a child and you've got somebody who is constantly telling you what to do, you simply never get to think for yourself. You don't get to make decisions, and you don't even get to take credit for when you do something well, because you're only doing it because somebody was screaming at you. More than anything, I really just think that what it actually does when parents are really, really heavily into this is it upsets the entire atmosphere. I think that those kinds of really aggressive or loud parents actually take away from the atmosphere rather than add to it.
Okay, so this is really a note to self. Maybe we need to exercise a little bit more self-control when we're on the sporting field.
Yeah, why not? And don't forget, silent sidelines as a concept, it's only once or twice a season, and it really is there just as a reminder for parents to behave themselves and let the kids enjoy the game.
It's funny that it's the parents that need reminding about how to behave and not the kids.
Ironic.
Yeah. Thanks, Justin. Good to catch up with you again.
Thanks, Katrina.
Okay, that's Dr. Justin Colson from happyfamilies.com.au. We'll be talking about the idea of silent sidelines. It's just one or two games a season where parents are to keep their mouths shut and let the kids play the game. Well, for me, one of the most exciting things about getting married was that I no longer needed to ever again look for a flatmate. There's nothing more stressful than trying to find a flatmate, looking for someone who will not only empty the garbage and pay the rent, but actually fit in with your life and your social circle. It can be such a big challenge. And people can have very different expectations of what they want in a flatmate. Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City is on the line to share her experiences. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Katrina.
What do you look for in a flatmate? Like, I was always someone that was looking to really share our lives and kind of be almost a little bit of an urban family, at least on weekends, whereas others just are happy to be ships in the night, barely see each other, not even share the same butter. What model were you after?
Well, if it's significant at all, I gave up looking for flatmates a couple of years ago and just decided to live by myself. I think because, yeah, I would definitely prefer the we are actually sharing our lives model. I have friends who live with strangers, or, you know, they're initially strangers, and it seems to go okay most of the time, but I just don't think I could ever do that.
But even living with friends can be fraught with danger, and for me, certainly living with friends hasn't gone all that well.
Yeah, it can be really tricky because particularly if you approach the situation with different expectations of what you'd like, you know, that can immediately be a big problem. So I've been really blessed in that the friends that I've been able to live with in the past, you know, we've gelled well together in the sense that, sure, we've fought and had difficulty sharing the space and all that sort of thing, but also we've been able to preserve the friendship and, I guess, approach life together and enjoy being in one another's lives. Whereas, yeah, certainly for some of my friends, living with their friends has been a bit of a nightmare. A lot of them, they also wanted to share space and share time with each other, but relationships changed and guys came on the scene and time needed to be spent elsewhere as well. And all of that, just negotiating all of the other relationships, can be really difficult. So, yeah, I think it's a very fraught issue. And I think that's part of why a lot of longer-term singles do end up living by themselves, which is absolutely statistically the reality in our city, at least. More and more people are living in single-person households.
Yeah, I guess it does get frustrating too, having people, you just get used to someone and then they move out, and having that circumstance changing all the time.
Yeah, and certainly for a lot of my longer-term single friends, that's the point we reach where it's like, I can't keep doing the, yep, that flatmate got engaged and left. Oh, that flatmate got engaged and left. Oh, that flatmate, you know. As everyone else, particularly those who do get married, you desire a bit of stability.
Yeah, so what do you think then makes a good flatmate? What's, for those who are currently living with others, what do you think makes someone, you know, good to live with?
Yeah. Look, I think as often we end up saying, one of the really key things is communication. So if you guys have never had a conversation about what your expectations actually are of one another and of the space, then that would be a really good conversation to instigate. Cook them dinner, sit them down, talk about what you actually want out of the space, even just to check that, are you wanting the same thing? And then for me, I think, like, I'm not sure what I would demand in a housemate, but ways I'd try to be a good flatmate. Just making sure that I'm clear about when I'm in and when I'm out. Like, even just simple things like that. You can expect that when you come home tonight, there will be 8 people in the lounge room. For me, stuff like that is really important because home is a refuge and it's always a bit of a surprise if you come home to, like, a lot of people. And, yeah, I think for me overall, the things that I've loved about house sharing is being there for the other person. And so I always would make sure that I had time in my day to ask them how their day was and chat about that. Which was a wonderful and delightful thing. And so I think if I ever were to go toward sharing a house again, I'd be looking to share with a friend or friends who are willing to kind of open up with each other and support one another in that way.
Yeah, okay. It is always seems to be in a state of flux, though, doesn't it, with living with flatmates? It's very rare that a situation stable and stays stable, and I guess that's why many people end up, as you said, living alone. So
absolutely, and that's the main thing that, it's like, I think a lot of married people completely don't understand about what being single for a long time means. You live with a lot of random people in a lot of difficult houses and a lot of spaces that often you don't own or have any control over. And the challenge of that is incredible. Yeah, living with strangers who aren't family and the difficulties that, yeah, I guess I also just wanted to say to all the folk living with their families, please remember and consider what it would be like if in your 30s or 40s you were still sharing a house with someone who's not your family.
I guess that's the thing, and who can opt out at any time. All right, Joanna, well, maybe next week we should talk about living alone.
Yeah.
And some of the pros and cons of that.
Sounds good.
All right, thank you. It's Joanna Hayes from celibateinthecity.net. We've been talking about the very vexing issue of finding a good flatmate. Now, Amanda has phoned in. Amanda, you can relate to everything that Joanna Hayes is saying.
Yeah.
What's your story?
Yeah, so I've had different flatmates. I've had somebody who just refused to wash up the cutlery.
Oh, no. That's my husband. He does that.
I don't know why. Why is it just the cutlery?
Because you've got to do it one by one. So if you do everything else, it looks as though you've washed up, but you've done the bits that are quick, and you leave the cutlery, and it looks like the deck's clear, but you're not doing the bit that takes the longest. Yeah.
I ended up writing a note to her from the cutlery saying you've washed me.
I should try that with hubby.
And I had flatmates who would never buy toilet paper or anything like that.
Mm.
Even now, and I live on my own now, I always have excess toilet paper because I'm paranoid about those days. and people who just wouldn't pay the bills or wouldn't do this. And even when I was in England and I was foreign to the country, I was the one who coordinated all of that. Totally over that whole situation.
And so living on your own is a better option?
Yep, I love it. Okay. I love it.
Well, that's good. Thank you for calling up, Amanda. We're going to talk more about living alone next week with Joanna Hayes, so I'll be interested to hear more about that too.
I'm going to listen to that one. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Amanda. Great to hear from you.
See you.
Hope 103.2 Mornings with Katrina Rowe.
The Culture Collective.
It's one of the best movies I've seen for ages.
Really fun series, but it's got a great underlying message.
Guaranteed 8 out of 10.
In this office, we're charged with tracing the relatives of those who passed away in the borough.
I see you in my office, please?
In the 2 months I've been here, I've been able to observe you at work.
Well, as I said, we found the dog in the apartment of Mr. Didion.
He's no doubt you're very thorough.
You're also very expensive, given the number of funerals you choose to organise as opposed to cremations. The council is undertaking a new round of efficiency savings. We're letting you go.
You're letting me go? What about this morning's case?
That'll be your last one.
John May works for a local council in London, finding the next of kin of people who've died alone. When he gets made redundant after 22 years on the job, he first has to complete one last assignment. That's the premise behind the movie Still Life, the new production from Umberto Pasolini, who did The Full Monty. Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity has been to the movies for us. Hi, Simon.
How you going, Katrina?
This is very intriguing. Tell us some more about the main character, John May.
He's a fascinating character. It's a really interesting film, this. As you said, it's this story of trying to find the families of people who've died. So this John May guy is a very kind of obsessive, compulsive kind of person, very quiet, a bit of a lonely person. But he takes this job very seriously, and he works really hard to try to find the friends or the family or people who knew these people who've died. And you see him attending all these funerals where with no one there other than him and the minister. And usually it's the minister reading out something about the person's life that John May's been able to cobble together from things he's found in their apartments and that sort of thing. So he sort of offers this as a gift to people who've died. It's quite moving, actually.
Yeah, it sounds like he's very kind of respectful of those who've died.
He is. He's trying to offer them something that they perhaps didn't have towards the end of their life. They're people whose lives have typically gone badly, so they've ended in this way. Mm. And so you see him enter these people's apartments, and what's left there are remnants of a life. So things like socks or framed pictures and their music, you know, records, CDs. There's coins left on the bedside table, all this sort of thing. It's a little bit confronting because you're seeing, you know, someone's life amount to just a whole lot of these little objects. And yet he's able to weave a bit of a story out of these objects. And it's a way of dignifying a life and I think showing the kind of value of the human person. Oh, it's a really gracious film.
Yeah, it sounds good. A lot of people will, of course, recognise Joanne Froggatt from her role as the beautiful Anna in Downton Abbey. Is she as endearing in this movie as she is in Downton?
Yeah, she is, and people will recognise her. She's got that lovely nature about her. And so she is the daughter of the final case that he has. He's trying to find the friends and family of Billy Stoke, who led a pretty colourful life. Kelly Stoke is his estranged daughter, and he finds her, and they're able to sort of talk about her father, and they strike up a bit of a friendship. Yes, she's lovely. She plays a nice role in the film.
What do you think the film is trying to say about death?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it puts before the viewer this question of our mortality. I think that's something we're very good at avoiding and distracting ourselves from. And so it's right at the centre of the film. And in that sense, it is confronting. And it's asking us the questions like, what is it that makes a life meaningful? And, of course, death is the big question that we all have to face at some point. And so as he comes into people's homes, he sees these things, you sort of get this sense of what sort of impact might this person's life have had on others and other people around us? And there's a sort of a subtle humour to the story. I have to be honest, it's a morbid topic, but in a way it's quite uplifting, especially because of this sort of quite strange man's attempt to offer something, a gift to these people, even as they've come to the end of their lives. It's really quite affecting.
So what kind of feeling did it leave you with then, Simon?
Well, it's sad. It's a bit of a sad film, but nonetheless, there's something quite deeply human about it. I think it shows the way, all these different ways of remembering a life that you see represented here, show us that, you know, humans take this very seriously, and there's something very important about a life that comes and then goes. It's not meaningless. I think one reflection could be you go in and see these people's lives and what point was it? But I think this person, John May, shows there's something meaningful. He does this really interesting thing where he, of all the cases that he deals with, He keeps one photograph of the person, and he keeps these in an album that he looks through. And you see him in one scene, he's flicking through this album and looking at these lives of people, you know, in better times or in parties or having fun with their friends. And it shows you something very powerful about the value of human life and the human experience. I think there's something that this story is trying to convey in that way. And, I found that very moving, actually.
So you'd recommend it then?
I would, but it's maybe not on a Friday night when you're just looking for a DVD. You have to be in the mood for this. It's very contemplative and, you know, perhaps isn't everyone's cup of tea. But if you go with it, and it's the sort of thing where that, you know, afterwards you'll find yourself wanting to talk to people about that type of film. I always think that's a good measure of a good film.
Yeah, absolutely, one that stays with you. Well, thank you, Simon.
Good on you, Chris. No problem.
That's Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity. We've been talking about Still Live. It stars Joanne Froggatt from Downton Abbey and Eddie Marsden.
Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
Can you believe it's been 20 years since Jeff Buckley released his album Grace? Well, this weekend, a new exhibition of photographs of Jeff Buckley is launching at the Blender Gallery in Paddington. Somebody who remembers Jeff Buckley well is our weekend announcer, Nick Bennett. Now, Nick, I believe you actually went to one of his shows.
I saw him, and then prior to the show, I had the pleasure of interviewing him, which was a very special time, because as radio workers back then, we were all really excited about the arrival of this album called Grace, and this guy called Jeff Buckley. So for the younger ones, like myself at the time, we didn't really know too much about the Buckley history, but for those ahead of us, they were really excited because his father was a very famous fella, Tim, who was a folky singer from California. So there's a lot of buzz when this Jeff Buckley guy arrived, and obviously the caliber of the music excited people greatly.
Nick, did you get to interview him face-to-face?
I did, yep. I was doing the Drive Time show on a radio station in Sydney at the time, and I teed this thing up, and I did a top 10 with Jeff. I faxed him ahead of time and said, look, have a think about what are your favourite songs and what things really move you and influence you. So he took some time to think about that, and he came in live, and it was maybe a Thursday afternoon about 4 o'clock, and he was a lovely man, really quite shy, and simply dressed in, you know, boots and jeans and T-shirt, typical kind of rock and roll guy, but not at all in your face. Just a really gentle, sensitive kind of soul. And not an easy interview. It was a little bit like pulling teeth.
Okay.
He was quite reserved. But
that's
when he did get going, when he started speaking about music, that was what he really loved. You could tell that was his thing. He was not really into talking about anything else.
Nick, tell us about the show, though, that you went to. Was it just amazing?
It was amazing. It was the Metro Theatre in George Street.
Oh, fantastic.
And at the time, Jeff kind of, I'm sure, inspired a whole lot of man singers to explore their range. He had an amazing range of between 3 and 4 octaves. He was a tenor. So there was a band from Melbourne called Quadrazine, and they opened the show and set the scene for what was, I think, towards the end of it, or before that, maybe midway through, it was like being in church. And you could really tell people were totally impacted by the depth of his spirit and the way that he sang. Jeff was really soulful, very sensitive, and a lot of elements of gospel to his music, which was interesting because he also could rock out really well. He was an amazing, very accomplished guitarist, and he played with a very tight 4-piece band. They were a rock band, but when they broke it all down, everything just fell away and they really walked the wire without a net, and the sensitivity was beautiful.
Wow. Was there a standout song that you remember him playing?
Probably Grace, Hallelujah. Hallelujah, I think. Yeah, without a doubt. That's the Leonard Cohen song, of course, and Jeff probably put that song back on the map, really. And you could argue that his version is way more famous than Leonard Cohen's.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's such a high-impact guy for such a short space, in such a short space of time. And it's good to know that, you know, 400,000 Australians own a copy of Grace.
I'm one of them.
Yeah.
Thanks, Nick. Wow.
Yeah, wonderful guy. So I'm glad that people are taking the time to remember Jeff. A really beautiful soul. And from what I can gather, there is no mystery really to his death. He just sadly passed away. It was accidental.
Thanks for phoning in to reminisce, Nick. Great to hear from you.
Pleasure.
Yeah, that's Nick Bennett, our weekend announcer, who not only went to Jeff Buckley's show, but also interviewed him beforehand. That's a pretty special memory. How often have you heard someone say, I've got an idea for a children's book, but how do you turn that idea into an actual book? Chocho Brierton is a writer and a dreamer who's just had the joy of seeing her idea turned into a beautiful picture book. Chocho is my special guest for Children's Book Week, which runs from Saturday, August 16th until Friday, August 22nd. Hi, Chocho.
Hi, Katrina.
Now, I have never met a children's author who didn't have the seeds of their work kind of sown in their own childhood. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, well, I kind of grew up in a few different places. I was born in Ghana in West Africa. So I grew up there for 5 years and that was pretty amazing. It's such a beautiful country. And then we moved to Ireland. I grew up there for about 4 years and then to England and that was the rest of my time there. And yeah, I've been in Australia for about 11 years now.
Ah, so. You still got a bit of the British accent.
I do. I'm hanging on to it with dear life.
Sure. And were you always a creative kid?
I was, you know, it's so weird. I look back now and I think there wasn't really a word for the sort of child I was, but I loved drawing and I loved writing, and now I can look back and go, oh, that was creativity. But back then I just thought that was who I was, and I was so immersed in it. I just found writing such a great way to escape into all these cool little worlds that I could make up and destroy in, you know, a few pen strokes. And so since I was about, I think, 4 or 5, maybe even 6, I've been writing non-stop. I think I can quite honestly say that. So
in the UK too, there's a lot of potential there. A lot of the sort of well-known English writers, the A.A. Milnes,
yes,
and even the Roald Dahls come from that country.
Absolutely.
What do you think that reading gives to a child?
I mean, it gives so much. First of all, it just gives them an excuse to have an imagination. I think that it's so important for children to just be able to throw themselves into these incredible, amazing worlds. I mean, think about the BFG by Roald Dahl. How insane is that? But amazing at the same time.
Love that book, yeah.
Absolutely love it too. And Matilda and all of those books. So I think reading does that. But also, especially with young children, reading with adults is such a fantastic time to have a very special bond with your child. And, you know, for a parent to do all the noises and make all the different accents, it really does help. I really believe that it helps develop children, especially literally. It's very important.
You have said that when you first started writing that you were rubbish at it.
Yes, I was. I was terrible. And that's what's so funny about it. I really knew what I wanted to get down on paper, but I just didn't have the skill to articulate it very well. So I had to read and read and write for 7 years. And that's just my story. Everyone will be different, you know, but for me, that's how it worked. And now I can say I'm a good writer and confidently say that, but I wouldn't have been able to say that a few years ago. Yeah.
So when was it that you got serious about writing? Because you said you've been doing it all your life,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I know you've worked in other jobs as well.
Yeah.
When did you go, nah, I'm not doing any more of anything else. I'm going to be a writer.
Yeah. It was actually... Yeah, it was a few years ago. I was actually a scientist, which really, I know. I really love science. I think it's something that was very inherent to me. But there was a point where I remember I was sitting down reading viral DNA. This is how exciting my job was. I was reading viral code and I just couldn't keep my mind on it. I really just wanted to be in this dream world where I was creating these awesome characters. And I remember speaking to my husband about it, and it was actually such a burning, I think you could say, that I couldn't ignore it anymore. So in the end, he was just like, if that's what you want to do, do it. Now, the problem with doing that is science was always a fallback for me, but they got to a point where it couldn't be a fallback anymore. I was either going to go forward with science or forward with writing. And there was a point where I was out of science too long to go back into it. And so my only way was forward. And I just thought, no, this is what I really, really want. This is what I desire. I'm going to work as hard as I can to make this happen.
So after all that hard work, you became an overnight success.
Thank you.
You know, with your very first children's manuscript being published.
Yes.
It's rather unheard of, really, for someone to write their very first manuscript and have it accepted. So how did that come about for you?
I've been told that, and I actually find that incredibly amazing. So I feel very privileged that it has happened. I remember thinking I'd love to have a professional look over this and tell me if it was substantial or not. And I went on to the a website that obviously listed everyone who was in the profession, and I liked the name of one woman. Her name was Margaret Hamilton, and I just thought, she sounds okay. So I booked a meeting with her and for her to appraise my manuscript, and she loved it. What I didn't know about Margaret Hamilton was that she was a guru in the industry. In the children's book publishing industry, she made so many names that are big names now. I had no idea. Anyway, she loved it, and so she said, look, send it to Walker Books, and I did, and I think that she called them and told them that this manuscript was coming through, and they accepted it. So how amazing is that?
So A House for Dawn Fickle, yeah. It's your first book. Tell us a little bit about it, and we'd love to hear a little bit as well, please.
Okay, well, very, very quickly, A House for Dawn Fickle is about this character called Dawn Fickle who builds a house, and then a whole bunch of critics come along and tell him what they don't like about it. He changes it to please them, in the end finds that that's not what he really wants, so with their help changes it back, and he's very happy, but I'm happy to read a little bit of it for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, thank you.
Up high in the grasslands where wobblebeasts roam, Don Finkel von Krinkel is building his home. The mud walls are perfect, the door just divine, the windows are beechwood, the porch is all pine. Don Finkel looks proudly from chimney to gate, and dreams of logs crackling as evenings grow late, when down swoops a flugel to babble and squawk, a bothersome taunt full of troublesome talk. The door is too shiny, the walls are too square, the porch is too piney, the roof is too bare. Don Finkel is fuddled by the flugel's whine, so changes the roof and the walls and the pine. No, no, shouts a mooble, his eyes wild and round. The roof looks all shobbly, the walls are not sound. Don Finkel is muddled by the mooble's cries, so props up his mud walls with sticks and grass ties.
The thing about this book is that it's so clearly designed to be read aloud, and I guess for adults to read aloud to kids.
Yes.
But there's a message in there for grown-ups too, isn't there, about not being the critic? Because, I mean, so often adults spend their time criticising children.
Absolutely. I think there's a I never set out to write a book with a message, but this one ended up being, and yeah, I found that a lot of adults have emailed me and said, oh, I was having issues trying to decide and people were telling me what to do. I think I'm just going to do what I want to do. Yeah. So on the reverse side, they've had that sort of a bit of more confidence just to go with their own thing. So it's been really interesting, the reactions to it, and they've all been very positive.
I guess we all need to back ourselves sometimes. Now, Chocho, you come from a Christian family.
Yes, I do.
What difference does knowing God make in your life and to your art?
Oh, all the difference, I think, is a fair thing to say. And I don't mean that, you know, as a throwaway statement. I really don't. I mean, when I began the whole journey of writing, I prayed about it quite consistently. And I wouldn't have gone down that direction if I really didn't feel as if it was God pushing me out of where I was. And even when it comes to stories and writing, and when I get stuck in my head with words that I just can't get on paper, asking him just for help really literally frees my mind up, and out come the words. And I always feel as if God just knows me so well. He knows exactly the stories I want to write. He knows what's in me. He knows my potential. And so I feel as if I'm not worried about reaching high. I think that with him, I can get high, even higher than I imagined. And so that's what I'm doing. I feel as if with him, I'll never be stuck for words, ever. You know, I'll always have a great story to write, and they'll just keep getting better because that's just the kind of God he is.
And he is a great storyteller.
Yes, absolutely. The best
All
one.
Right. Well, seeing this book come out and being so well received must be, I guess, a real pleasure. What's your message to other dreamers who have high hopes of aiming high and making their mark in the arts?
Oh, man, go for it. You know, every day is such a precious gift. I really believe that. And I just think, don't waste it doing something that is not in you. You know, I think we all feel as if we have to do the right thing by, I don't know, choosing the job that perhaps we don't like. And I understand that. But if you have a dream in you, go for it. Just do it. And you'll be surprised how far you get. I really, really, really absolutely believe that 100%. And so if anyone wants to aim for a dream, no matter how big it is, you have to start small, of course, but start anyway. And if you're scared, do it scared anyway. You have to. Yeah, I think that's what I'd like to say.
That's Chocho Britton, whose first picture book, A House for Dawn Fickle, was published by Walker Books earlier this year.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with life words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.